Hi, welcome to this week's program. I know almost all my listeners have heard of 401ks, and a lot of you have them in your retirement portfolios. But while 401ks offer a lot of benefits, like anything else, they have downsides too, and you must assess your financial situation carefully before going all in on your 401k. This is also about those of you who work for government or nonprofit, so it includes 457s as well. So to make sure you get the most from your plan, I plan to talk about 401k pros and cons, with a special focus on the cons, because 9 in 10 Americans are not aware of the downsides of 401ks and how they might be better off supplementing their 401k with other investment options. So let's start with the pros. A 401k is basically a savings plan that allows employees to make tax-deductible contributions towards retirement, where the money goes straight from your paycheck to the plan before you can lay your hands on it. And that's a good thing because you learn to make do with smaller paycheck, so think of it as a form of forced savings. What's neat about this tax deferral is that you get to invest more than if you had to pay taxes on that amount, and you compound this money without paying current tax today, which helps you build a larger nest egg. Now, the government always gets its cut, so you'll have to pay taxes on the distributions when you take them later in life, hopefully at a lower rate of tax than when you made your contributions. For 2017, your contribution is limited to $18,000, but if you're age 50 or more, you can make an additional $6,000 in catch-up contributions every year to a maximum of $24,000. So these are fairly generous and meaningful limits with the intent of helping you build up for a comfortable retirement. And remember, it's elective. It's not mandatory. Every year, you get to decide how much you want to contribute towards the plan, if at all. Another great feature of these plans is that employers have the option of making contributions to your plan. Typically, employers make matching contributions based on the amount you put in, and their match can go from anywhere from nothing to 100%. If your employer offers matching contributions but you don't have a 401k plan set up, you're missing out on free money. So I strongly urge you to take advantage of this matching feature. With a 401k, your employer works with a plan administrator and decides what you can invest in. Most plans offer a fairly limited set of 10 to 12 investment options, such as mutual funds, exchange-traded funds or ETFs, or index funds, and you can change your investments at least once every quarter. So the upside here is that your investment options are tailored to offer a reasonable degree of diversification while focusing on safety and acceptable market risk. This dampens speculation and helps employees stay invested over the long run, which is vital to growing wealth. Also, employers offer a plan document every year that highlights investment options, how often you can change your investments, your fees, and so on. Most companies also hold planning sessions every year for employees, so attend those meetings and stay on top of the plan features and changes. And if you ever have any questions about your plan, talk to your HR department. They should be able to help you out. Now, in my list of 401k pros and cons, here's the last pro. The IRS permits early withdrawals from your plan before you reach age 59 and a half, but it makes you pay a 10% penalty on that early withdrawal. So, dipping into your plan before age 59 and a half is not a good idea, but that said, if you withdraw money for medical expenses or disability, the IRS waives the 10% penalty, which is nice because it gives you liquidity in the face of financial hardship. All right, so that covers the major benefits of 401k plans. Now let's talk about the cons. Let's start with the tax deductible feature. While the original intent was that you'd be in a lower income tax bracket when you retire because you won't be earning as much, this is not always the case. If you've done well professionally and you've invested well through the years, mandatory retirement withdrawals and other sources of income, say rental income from real estate, could put you in a higher tax bracket than when you were working. As a result, you could pay more in taxes than if you had simply invested your money after tax originally, or better yet, in vehicles like the Roth IRA, where you pay no future tax on your gains. So the tax benefits of a 401k may not always work in your favor, and you could end up shouldering a big tax liability if your portfolio does well and you end up in a higher income bracket than when you started, which can often be the case. Moreover, if the bulk of your savings in a 401k and similar tax-deferred vehicles could lead to a situation where most of your future income is taxable. So after-tax investments have their own benefits. Here's a really good example. Let's say you're over age 70 and a half and you have $2 million in tax-deferred assets, $150,000 in already taxed assets, and let's say you need $50,000 to live every year. Now remember, the government wants the taxes you owe them, so on that $2 million, you'll have to withdraw what's called the required minimum distribution, known as the RMD. This RMD comes from your tax-deferred retirement accounts. At $2 million, the RMD works out to about $73,000. So now you're in a situation where you have to withdraw an extra $23,000 that you don't need and pay taxes on it. So having too much in tax-deferred assets doesn't always work to your advantage. And in case you're wondering how I got that $73,000 RMD figure, it's based on a governmental formula, and I've included a link to it on my website, stevepomerantz.com. Now, it also does not always make sense to invest to the max. You should assess your situation and talk to a knowledgeable financial advisor to see if you should go all in and invest up to the contribution limit, or if you should restrict your contribution to just the amount that would get you the full employer matching contribution. But to be clear about one thing, make sure you get the entire amount of the employer match because that's free money. Now, the investment part of this equation is a bit of a minefield. For one, the options offered are often too limited and are made up of stodgier and more expensive funds. While stodgy may be good as you're approaching retirement age, it's not so good if you're young. And depending on your age, it may make sense to minimize your 401k and direct your monies to where you have more aggressive investment choices. The other downside is that the plan administrator may direct you to mutual funds they manage or have an interest in, and this is in order to maximize their own fees and expenses at the expense of your nest egg. This conflict of interest is a major problem with how 401ks are administered, and there was a study by NerdWallet in 2013 which found that 93% of all Americans dramatically underestimated the total 401k fees that they paid over a lifetime. More than half thought the lifetime fees would be under $50,000, but the reality is that the average household with two working adults will pay about $150,000 to $200,000 in fees over their lifetime. The good news in all this is that all this bad publicity has stirred a move towards lower fees and better investment options, but still, 401k-related fees are still pretty high, so double-check the fees you'll pay before you sign up. You know, and as I always say, make sure any investment you make makes sense for your particular situation, and the same goes for the 401k. If you have high credit card debt, or student loans, or need to save for a down payment on a house, maybe you want to take care of that first. If you don't have at least 4 to 6 months of your pay in emergency funds, build that up first. Then after you've taken care of the essentials, see if you should open up a 401k. Finally, remember that bit about hardship withdrawals? You could always tap into investments in after-tax funds without penalties, but if you mostly put it all in tax-deferred assets, you will have to pay the 10% penalty. So think carefully about 401k pros and cons and wisely allocate your funds so you don't have to pay taxes on all your withdrawals in retirement. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. A few weeks ago, I was thumbing through the Wall Street Journal, and I saw an article entitled, In Defense of the Dismal Science. Now, the dismal science is a somewhat derogatory name given to the science of economics. Greg Ipp is its author, and Greg is the chief economics commentator for the Wall Street Journal, and he joins me today to discuss it. Hey, welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks for having me on the show, Steve.
So why in the first place does economics have to be defended these days?
Well, I kind of feel it needs to be defended because economists are getting criticized left, right, and center. In my article, I cite one particularly egregious example of the former head of the statistical agency in Greece. Now, even though he's a statistician, he's an economist by training. And his alleged sin was to basically tell the truth about just how big Greece's debts were 6 or 7 years ago. And that made the resulting austerity and recession worse. So a lot of folks in Greece, instead of sort of like thanking him for getting the real numbers out there, blame him for the bad stuff that happened after the true size of the debts became known. And so he was pursued by prosecutors over a number of years. And even though he was acquitted twice by courts, in at least one case, the charges are reinstated. And in August, he was convicted of sentenced to 2 years in prison, basically for crimes linked to the execution of his duties. That would be just one example, but we've seen less egregious examples much closer to home. In Britain last year, a lot of economists, including the governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, warned that voting to leave the European Union could be bad for the British economy. And a lot of folks, including some members of parliament, said this was a terrible politicization of the bank, that he was saying things that simply were not true and he should resign. And I guess the most recent example would be right here in the United States. In Washington, we have an agency called the Congressional Budget Office. It's nonpartisan. It's mostly made up of analysts. A lot of them are economists. Their job is to give Congress the most unbiased analysis they can on the decisions they have to make. And they have put out a number of reports that said repealing or replacing the Affordable Care Act would significantly increase the number of people without health insurance. President Trump's budget director has attacked the CBO on several occasions for this analysis. And Trump's staff penned an op-ed saying that anything that comes out of the CBO on this question should be treated as fake news. So those are a few of the incidents. But we see this in polls, too. Broader skepticism for economists and economic data among the broad public. So that's why I felt it was time to actually step back and say, well, what is it that economists do and what should the public expect of them?
Yeah, that's a very good question. First of all, it's a 200-year-old science. How did it start? How did economics get its first intellectual approach?
Well, before there was economics, there was moral philosophy. And the first economists, people like David Hume and Adam Smith, were moral philosophers. And economics, which at the time they actually called political economy, what it had in common was the people who were associated with this new discipline were trying to find ways to understand human behavior and how society organized itself that did not require you to basically defer to some higher moral or political authority. And what these folks did was they determined through force of argument that when people are left to pursue their own best interests, that in itself is in some sense an organizing principle for society that yields in many cases the best outcome. Probably the most memorable phraseology to capture this was Adam Smith's reference to the invisible hand
of the free market,
which he talked about in the Wealth of Nations.
What is that invisible hand? What does that mean?
Well, basically, what Smith was saying was the invisible hand is essentially, as he put it, the baker or the butcher in pursuit of their own interest. They basically sell their product to the person who's willing to pay the highest price. The worker puts his effort into producing that thing that gets him the highest wage. The consumer spends his or her money on the thing that gives him or her the most satisfaction. And all these decisions, even though individually driven by the individual's own interest, produce a social outcome that's best for everybody.
The idea that a doctor who can take care of her child quite well decides to actually take care of other people and use that money that she makes to hire a nanny to take care of her child, this has this broader implications multiplied millions fold, creates this giant movement, this invisible hand.
Well, the example you've just given is an interesting one, Steve, because in 1817, in fact, we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of the publication of this book. It was a book by David Ricardo, another great economist, and he established the theory of comparative advantage. And what his theory basically said was that even if you as a country, let's say the United States, can make tires more efficiently than another country like China, it might actually make sense for you to make something else where you're even more efficient, like growing grain. And then you become an exporter of grain and an importer of tires from China. That's the theory of comparative advantage. Now, most people have struggled with this theory and cannot understand why the United States would want to trade with poorer countries when we can actually make things more efficiently than those other countries. And the reason quite simply is that there's only so many people in the labor force and so many hours in the day. And you want them spending those hours doing the thing they're best at, and then they can sell the thing they produce and use that money to buy the other things they don't produce, and everybody's better off.
Well, we seem to be operating in a world that fits that model almost perfectly, even though there's a movement afoot to try to slow it down or to put obstacles in front of that. Moving along, though, on this, the history of economics, Paul Samuelson wrote a book which brought mathematical analysis into the picture. What happened then?
So I think this is important because economics, as I said a few minutes ago, began as this attempt to try and divorce human behavior from moral considerations and put it in sort of the result of more amoral sort of like drivers. The next step was to quantify these drivers, to quantify things like supply and demand and wage rates and the return on capital and so forth. And that's what Paul Samuelson did. He comes along in the 1940s and he actually devotes his PhD thesis at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology to using advanced math to basically lay out a lot of the theories and axioms that economists have been using for over a century. And this begins what I would call the mathematical revolution in economics, where more and more of the things that economists try to explore, whether it's the behavior of interest rates, the behavior of unemployment, supply and demand, monopolistic behavior, that they actually express these in mathematical terms. Mm-hmm. And as economists get ever more theory and ever more computing power at their fingertips, the discipline becomes more scientific, more mathematical, or at least it tries to appear more scientific. And economists kind of get this idea that, hey, if we just try hard enough, we can be as objective and as predictive as, say, physics.
Yeah, let's get into that a little bit, because the mathematical models have helped quite a bit, but they've also led so many astray. I'm thinking about the 2007-2008 recession, where a lot of the investment banks built entire trading desks and the concepts on which they traded on these very complicated mathematical systems, and the whole system blew up, and economists weren't able to forecast that either, and neither was anybody from the Federal Reserve able to do that as well. So the ability of these mathematical models are somewhat limited, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. And indeed, I think the idea that using more math would give economics greater predictive power was in some sense a chimera. It was a dream that was never going to be fulfilled. Mm-hmm. So economists were able to write more elaborate forecasts, but they've never been very accurate. Frankly, if you just look at what the growth rate or the inflation rate was last year, that your forecast for this year, you'll probably do better than most economic forecasts. Mm-hmm. And what economists have run into time and again is that trying to predict the behavior of individuals or groups of individuals or an entire economy is a very different exercise from trying to predict, for example, how a celestial body moves through the skies.
Yeah.
Because people are sort of varied. They don't respond to the same phenomena the same way among each other or the same way over time. They might respond, for example, to a rise in the price of housing by buying fewer houses, or they might buy more houses if they think the price are going to go up.
Yeah, you never know.
Later.
Yeah.
And it's also very difficult for economists and financial people to understand how these factors sometimes interact and alter expectations. And that is why economists are almost always surprised by recessions.
Yeah.
That's why they're repeatedly surprised by financial crises.
My guest is Gregory Yip. He is the chief economics commentator for the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about In Defense of the Dismal Science. We'll be back in just a moment with Greg. Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomeranz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomeranz Show, and I'm Steve Pomeranz. I was speaking with Gregory Ip. He is the chief economics commentator for the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about his article, In Defense of the Dismal Science. Greg, you know, I guess I want to ask the question is, these days, economists are so disdained by so many different groups, either on the left or on the right. Why is that?
I think one of the problems is that economists pride themselves on being, you know, quote, scientific, unquote. They want to quantify everything, human motivation, desire, behavior. But people are not really quantitative by nature. They're driven by things like emotion and feelings and senses of community and desires for fairness. And those feelings are often at the center of our most divisive debates. You know, on the left, you have people very concerned about inequality and fairness. Economists can measure inequality, but they cannot tell you what is the right measure of distribution that we should have in the economy. That's just not a question economists can answer. It really depends on your political preferences. From the right, you have people criticizing economists for praising globalization. They're saying, what about borders? You know what I mean? You say immigration is good for growth. What about the fact that some people are uncomfortable with a lot of immigrants, illegal or legal? Those are questions about community and cohesion and national identity that, once again, economists simply cannot answer, in some cases, even relate to. So I think one of the problems economists are running into this rejection is that they're not equipped to answer the questions that people most badly want answers to.
Yeah. Well, economists tend to move towards the globalization concept. As you said earlier, this idea that if we make tires here efficiently, that's fine. But if we grow grain even more efficiently, we should sell the grain abroad and buy the tires from abroad. That's a globalization strategy. That's an efficiency productivity strategy. But people's lives are also affected, and economics doesn't take that into account. Did I say that correctly, you think?
That's exactly right. An economist would say if importing tires means 10,000 tire factory workers lose their jobs, that's okay because 100 million people will get cheaper tires. But a lot of Americans would say, no, that trade-off is not worth it. I think that people should be willing to pay more for tires so that those factory workers don't lose their jobs.
Yeah.
And that is the kind of thing that economists cannot sort of dictate answers one way or the other to. And I think it's interesting that free trade, it's one of the most difficult concepts in economics to grasp, but it's one around which there's almost universal support among economists. And you find it's almost the exact opposite among the public. And indeed, one of the things that makes Donald Trump special is that he has been against free trade pretty much all his life, as far as I can tell. And he is the first person to run for president against free trade and as president to actually try and implement the protectionist measures that he talked about. In the past, people would run for president and say, I'm going to like stick up for the American worker, but then they would agree to the free trade consensus once they were in office.
But his businesses are pretty much all supported by free trade, by overseas workers and so on.
Well, it's certainly true that Trump has sought to extend his brand overseas, and he's been a beneficiary of migrant workers here in the United States. But speaking in terms of the political rhetoric and the policy approach, it's interesting that his opposition to free trade may be the only thing where he and leading Democrats in Congress agree.
Oh, that's interesting. Everything is flipped on its head. This is not a political discussion, but, you know, nothing is as it used to seem. So let's get back to this idea about the economist's dismal track record of forecasting stuff. So I think we can all say with certainty that they're tremendously lousy at that. Going back to the 2007-2008 crisis, while economists didn't predict it, they sure did a lot to arrest it, didn't they? To save it.
They did. And in fact, I think you could draw an analogy between economics and medicine. We don't expect doctors to predict exactly the day you'll die or how you'll die. They simply look at your health and they offer you advice on what the risks to your health are and the sorts of things that are likely to increase or decrease your risk of early death. And that's really what we should be asking of economists. And when these crises actually hit, they had learned a lot from events like the Great Depression and crises in other countries. And they were able to advise the central bank, the Federal Reserve, to lend heavily to troubled banks and other financial companies to arrest the crisis. And then they also advised President Obama and Congress to pass a very large fiscal stimulus to soften the impact of the recession. So in that respect, economists have been helpful in terms of bringing their experience and knowledge in theory to bear on some of these questions. To say that they failed us because they cannot pinpoint when particular events are going to happen, I think is holding them to the wrong standard. Mm-hmm.
You know, economists also look at the consequences of certain actions. If there's a tariff, you know, it may benefit domestic steelmakers and their workers, but it can raise prices for the public. If you raise the minimum wage, it'll help a certain group of people. But then how will companies actually respond to that? Are they going to automate more? Are they going to pass those higher costs through to the consumer, which will raise prices? That doesn't always get a good reception, you know, from the common man or from those of us who are lay people like myself.
Well, that's right. I think the economist is trained to look for something that we call equilibrium, which is really a fancy way of saying, well, if you change this price or this factor, what else will change and where will things end up? So let's consider something very controversial, which is an increase in the minimum wage. Now, a lot of people say we should increase the minimum wage, and that way people who have low skills and are earning the minimum wage will have more money to spend.
Yeah.
Well, the economist says, well, that's true as far as it goes, but what happens on the other side? Do employers employ fewer of these people?
Yeah.
Do they reduce the wages of other people? Are they forced to raise prices and that hurts their customers? Do they lose market share to other towns that have not raised their minimum wage? And sometimes when you work your way through all these different interacting conditions, you come up with surprising answers. Little increases in the minimum wage don't seem to hurt. Large increases do seem to hurt. Now, the problem economists often have is that the public often only hears what they want to hear.
Mm.
So if you're a politician and you're inclined to oppose the minimum wage, you only hear the second part, which is large increases hurt jobs. If you're a politician inclined to support the minimum wage, you only hear the first part, small increases don't hurt jobs.
Yeah.
And economists, I know, drove Harry Truman crazy. They would always say on the one hand and yeah. on the other hand. But often that's the type of advice that they offer. It all depends on exactly how you go about implementing a policy.
Great. Switching gears here, you know, we are experiencing an explosion of data through all the media that we're consuming and the social media and other ways that the internet is digitalizing everything and just, as I said, creating this massive amounts of data. And I know that scientists are starting to use that data to get more accurate predictions of what's going on. Is that happening in economics as well?
It is to a certain extent. You do have some economists out there trying to scrape the internet in search of data that you couldn't get before. So one example would be the Million Prices Project, which is a project that scrapes the internet for prices on stuff to see if you can get a more accurate and timely gauge of what's happening with inflation than just listening to the government data. And companies like Uber that generate a lot of data in the process of fulfilling their services sometimes will make that data available to economists who want to do interesting studies. Oh, now we can really find out if you change the price of a taxi ride, how does it change the demand for taxi rides?
Yeah.
And what do drivers do? So, yes, the explosion of data has offered a lot of new ways to measure some problems. But I would say the more significant change you've seen in economics actually predates the availability of the data. And it's really a bottom-up desire to like put a lot of the things that were always theoretical assumptions in economics to empirical tests to see what really happens.
Yeah.
And so if you actually look at the types of articles and studies that economists publish, you do occasionally have a theoretical paper that's stuffed full of Greek letters and doesn't seem to have any connection to reality. But much more often, you'll see a very careful attempt to go through data, some of which is widely available, like the unemployment data the government publishes, or sometimes maybe a very specialized set of data that only that economist managed to get a hold of because they have a special relationship with a company or a particular information provider. And that way, they're able to test all sorts of interesting questions and propositions. In that respect, economics is becoming a less politicized, less ideologically driven discipline, even though, to be sure, economists can still be ideological and political, and that will affect sometimes the advice they give.
So I want to add my two cents here, with your permission. First of all, I want to make a change to the title of your article. I want to call it In Defense of Bean Counters Everywhere. Now, a bean counter is an accountant. It's an economist. It's anybody who's really using math or using real data to make decisions and to analyze. You know, in today's times, the proliferation of opinion masquerading as fact is all around us and has gotten to a point where it's sometimes quite difficult to know the real facts. When I was coming up in my profession, As an investment advisor, there was some less than positive talk about businesses that were run by accountants. Accountants were kind of looked at as, you know, not great business people and so on, and that even economists were detrimental to good investment results. I remember reading in the Peter Lynch book, who managed the incredibly popular Fidelity Magellan Fund, that the reason he thought that he was so successful was that Fidelity did not have an economist on its staff. So back then, you know, entrepreneurism was the new wave and creative thinking and great sales made the day, and kind of bean counters were considered to be holding businesses back from attaining its true potential. But I think right now times have changed. Now it's time to raise up the bean counters everywhere. Forensic accountants and auditors and economists, all those who serve us with facts and statistics and use science to quantify the world around us. Yes, as Greg states, economists should be defended, but let's defend other dismal sciences as well. So this is to all you great bean counters in the world. I thank you. And I also thank you, Greg, for joining us today. Thanks, Greg.
All right. It was great to talk to you.
To learn more about your money and to interact with us, don't forget to go to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
When you go to sell a home, you guys have got to figure out what the features of the home would make the most impact to a potential buyer. Like fashion, this stuff changes all the time. It drives me a little crazy. So what is the first thing you want to mention in your listing these days?
Well, one of the hot items is quartz. And quartz is a material that it's replacing granite, you know, in kitchens and bathrooms. And you found quartz primarily in 500,000 plus luxury market homes. But today you're seeing quartz being put into everybody's home.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say everyone's home.
Yeah,
but
I get the point.
Right. So it's a more expensive product than granite, but that's the hottest thing out there. So when you're marketing a home, you can say it has quartz. Mm-hmm. It's like, woo, it's got quartz.
Yeah, but if you sell it 5 years from now, it's probably going to be bamboo.
That's right.
Or something. You know,
it'll be something else. That's the crazy thing. You know, we were talking about on an earlier show, the average age or the average amount of time people stay in the house is now 9 years.
Yeah.
Well, I'm in my house 12 years and I've already redone my house, and now I feel like I have to do it again.
Mm.
And I think people are staying because in a lot of cases now it's cheaper just to change some things out than it was to go ahead and buy another house that's already redone.
Yeah.
So I think that might be some of the reason why people are just staying put in their houses.
Well, is there such a thing as quartz veneer?
Just change out. Yeah, well, I'm
Just
sure
put it
is.
Over. Just paste it on. All right, let's
linoleum.
Move on.
Linoleum that looks like quartz. And actually, linoleum is expensive.
Oh, yeah.
I went shopping recently and I couldn't believe how expensive linoleum was. Is that what it's called? Linoleum on countertops or laminate?
Oh, no, laminate.
Laminate.
Definitely not linoleum.
Yeah, linoleum's floors. Okay.
Laminate.
It's expensive. They don't. I think it's so expensive because nobody buys it anymore.
What other features are realtors listing these days?
Well, believe it or not, nickel faucets. Mm-hmm. They're outselling the stainless steel, the chrome, the bronze.
Mm-hmm.
It's just more popular. So, you know, if you're looking to upgrade your house a little bit, and this is an inexpensive thing you can do, you can just change out your faucets.
To nickel. Okay.
From your chrome.
What about carpet and hardwood floors and vinyl? What's the best there?
What's better? Hardwood floors and luxury vinyl tile. Those are the most popular things you're now seeing in kitchen floors.
Okay.
That's the direction.
Okay. Well, let's see. I'm sorry, listeners. I'm thinking about my own house. I have hardwood floors, so I feel good about that.
Me too.
Yeah. All right. Here's another one. So, you know, I always hated spa tubs.
Yeah.
The jacuzzis, even when they were popular, how are they doing?
Well, they've dropped like you know, they were being installed in about 15% of new homes in 2015, and now it's down to 11%. So that's just dropping. People do not take bubble baths. I've always said that. They're a waste of money. I have one, and I'm in the process of trying to find somebody to get rid of it. I don't even know if it works.
Yeah. I just never liked this whole idea of having all that water shooting out.
And I want to relax. It takes forever to fill up. And by the time you fill it up with water, it's cold because you ran out of hot water in your tanks. You need a bigger tank to fill it up to put water in your bubble bath.
All right, changing gears here. So there's a lot of talk and a lot of articles written about people buying tiny homes. But again, there may be some hidden costs with tiny homes. Tell us about that.
Not really an expert at tiny homes, but what I can tell you is the foundation is an important aspect to it. For example, it's estimated to be about $25,000 for a foundation versus $35,000 for a trailer. So you can put the home on a foundation or like a mobile home on a trailer. That's a huge, cost
difference. So there's an extra, it's cheaper to build a foundation is what you're saying.
Correct.
Okay. Then to actually put your home on a trailer.
On wheels. Okay. I think they call it an RV.
Yeah. By the way, what size home is considered a tiny home?
Anything that's 400 square feet or less.
Wow. That is really... That's like two bedrooms worth.
Yeah, they're really neat though, because I actually got to see one and it had everything. It had a kitchen, had everything but a bathroom. It was an outhouse.
If you go to IKEA, I haven't been in a long time, but they have How to Live in 200 Square Feet. And you can really see it. I mean, there is a bathroom, there is a kitchen. The bathroom's right next to the kitchen. Well, everything's right next to the kitchen. But the bed, the TV's up in the corner by the ceiling and all of that stuff. You know, they've kind of figured out this thing. I could never live that way, but a lot of people like that.
Yeah. And getting a mortgage, if you're considering a tiny home, know that getting a mortgage is difficult. Mm-hmm. It may be considered an unsecured personal loan versus, a traditional mortgage.
That makes sense.
And that's due to the mobility of these homes and the small footprint.
Can you insure these homes?
Well, that too is also a challenge. And that's something you need to look into. Tiny homes built on trailers need to have an RV certification, which is different than if it's built on a foundation.
Okay.
And it depends on who built it. Is it one of these do-it-yourself projects or, was it built by the Tiny Home Industry Association?
Oh.
So again, something to be aware of. Zoning laws, they can get in your way. Of course, if you're in a rural area, they're going to be more lenient. Mm-hmm. I don't know how easy it is to put a tiny home in a regular homeowner association residential neighborhood.
Yeah.
But be aware of zoning laws when considering a tiny home.
And finally, what about resale value?
Resale. Well, again, if it's on a foundation and it's in a location, it's not going to be different than anything else.
No.
If you're in the right location, have a foundation, it will appreciate. If it's a property more like an RV on wheels, it's most likely going to depreciate like a car.
Gotcha. My guest, as always, is Terry Story. Terry is a 28-year veteran with Coldwell Banker located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Ever wonder what goes on at the SEC, you know, the Securities and Exchange Commission? That's the agency whose primary purpose is to make sure that the financial service providers in this country operate within the law to ensure the overall economic health of the country. Let's take a look inside this SEC to find out. And to do that, I've invited Norm Champ. Norm is the former director of the Division of Investment Management at the SEC, and he has a new book. It's entitled Going Public, My Adventures Inside the SEC and How to Prevent the Next Devastating Crisis. Also, Mr. Champ is a lecturer on investment management at Harvard Law School. Welcome to the show, Norm.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve. Really appreciate it.
So I didn't know you could have adventures inside the SEC, but we'll just pass that for a second. Look, in 2008, Americans were reeling from the devastating financial crisis that caused the Great Recession. We all know about this. We've all felt it. And there were a lot of questions about how the crisis was allowed to happen. And then, of course, calls for immediate reform. And then, the multiple scandals like the Madoff scandal sent real fear throughout the investment community. And it put a lot of pressure on the SEC. So right about that time in 2010, you joined the SEC. Why did you join at that time?
Yep. So I took the oath in January of 2010. And that was really, just right after the crisis. I think the main motivation for me was that I had worked with the SEC my whole career, right? As a young lawyer, working on offerings and working on M&A deals and speaking with SEC people and working with them. And they had this reputation as this expert agency that was fulfilling the mission of markets in the United States and capital formation. And here they were, I think of any agency in the crisis, they took the biggest tumble from being that expert to being basically derided all around the street. And it was hard to watch. And I thought that I had this expertise around expert asset management and that it would make sense to come in and try to offer some of that expertise to help them fulfill their mission.
Well, you were still on the outside. And what did you actually think you would find once you got there?
So I thought that it would be more expert than it was. I thought it would be more market savvy than it is. It's a place where people end up staying a long time because it has tremendous, it has tremendous benefits and sort of lifetime employment. You can never be fired. And so it had gotten a little stagnant in its thinking about markets and what it was doing. And things had really gotten ossified. It was much more bureaucratic and ossified and sort of, doing things the way they did them because they always did them that way. There was much more of that than I expected.
Yeah, so there was this idea of what you thought you would find when you got in there, and then what you actually did find. Would you characterize that as being much worse?
Yes. So some of it, I often, say to people, some of it you just couldn't make up, right? The idea that the examiners who were examining Madoff, examining Stanford, the idea that they had no manual, no framework of how to conduct exams and what to do when they went to conduct exams and what to look for was just stunning because SEC rules require investment advisors and broker-dealers to have manuals to set out how they're going to do their job, how you're going to prevent fraud, how you're going to protect the client, all those things. And yet, my second or third week, the examiners asked me, well, how do you want this exam done? And I said, well, don't we have some guidance, some sort of framework? Well, we sort of, we kind of know how to do these things.
Yeah,
and
that
easily was the biggest surprise.
Well, I mean, the irony is so that, I've been in the investment world for 35 years, and you're right. The amount of material and requirements and manuals and checklists, and I mean, it goes on and on and on. What we are required to have on premises and in our compliance departments and the like is incredible. And you're basically, I'm hearing from you, they don't follow their own rules.
So there was very little infrastructure, very little setting down of how you're going to do things. And one of the lasting accomplishments of what we did while we were there was to get a manual in place in the exam division and also get a manual in place in the Division of Investment Management. Those are things that will be there for, I think, a long time and people will follow them. And I think that will help protect investors and help the SEC get back on its feet.
In the private sector, you have the ability as a manager to install monetary rewards, monetary carrots. In the public sector, are monetary rewards appropriate?
They are, and I would like to see more of them. The real crux of the cultural problems in government now, and this is not just the SEC, this is across all kinds of governments. The real crux of the problem is there are neither carrots nor sticks. So the SEC and the public employee union that represents employees there could never agree on a pay-for-performance system. So there was no way to reward the high performers and pay them more. And so when we did surveys of employees, that was the number one sticking point, right? Because people come in there, they're devoted to the mission, they kill themselves, they work really hard. The guy two doors down is doing nothing, right?
Yeah.
And that inability to reward the hard worker makes the government environment very difficult.
So was the union, the public employees union, is that very, very strong in the SEC or across government?
They are very strong at the SEC and very strong across many arms of the federal government and similar to the state level. And it is something that they help make the culture very difficult because they are constantly trying to get more benefits for their employees, right?
Sure.
They don't have to do day-to-day work for the SEC if they are the union rep. So their goal is to be reelected as the union rep, which means you got to get more benefits for employees. Now,
I see.
To me, that's actually pretty logical. I mean, in other words, a lot of my colleagues railed at that. I was like, look, this guy wants to get reelected. He's going to try to get more benefits for employees. That's what he's doing.
That's the job of the union, is to get more benefits.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so to expect him not to is not that realistic. Now, of course, I would love to see some changes so that they weren't able to do that, but we had the system we had. And so one of the things I really sort of made a strategic decision right away was that I wanted to work with them because, you know, they were there long before I was. Yeah. They're going to be there long after, right? Yeah. If I fight them and try to punch them in the nose, it's just not going to happen. So, and they had some motivation to make some changes as well because their examiners were being pilloried in the paper and there was all these, you know, there was a lot of heat. And so I spoke to the union every Tuesday morning for 5 years and we worked to make a lot of changes together. And I really put my effort on that as opposed to trying to fire people. Some people come in, they're like, you know, I'm going to fire this guy, fire that guy. Effectively, you cannot fire anyone because of civil service rules and the union rules. So you spend a lot of brain damage on trying to fire somebody and you don't get anywhere.
But you mentioned in the book that, and I'm going to quote here, quiet patriots who triumph despite the system. It sounds great. Can you give us an example of that?
Sure. So you have all this chaos, you have a lot of things going on, and you have people who aren't doing their jobs. And yet you have people who come there, they're there for public service, they want to do the right thing, they want to protect investors, they want to make things better. And so it's those people that the book is dedicated to because they screen out all this noise and they're out there protecting investors every day. And they're doing it in ways that mostly the public will never know about. So one example that I talk about in the book that I think is most telling is there was a broker-dealer that was in a lot of trouble in 2011, almost failed, and that failure would have been the largest failure of a U.S. broker-dealer by far, by number of accounts and by amounts of people impacted. And literally a team of people worked behind the scenes tirelessly, you know, traveling away from their homes for weeks, months at a time, doing everything they could to essentially, we found a buyer ultimately for it. And you know, in the end, we got someone to buy most of the assets, the rest of the assets declared bankruptcy, and investors were not harmed. No one had to go through a SIPC proceeding to sort out a bankrupt broker-dealer, right? And that's one of those ones where you see people just sacrificing everything.
Is that the function of someone in SEC to find a buyer for a troubled company?
Not usually, but in the immediate post-crisis, you know, meltdown atmosphere, I think we all felt like we had to get more involved. You just couldn't. Yeah, you just couldn't have another failure because there was so much attention and so much going on. And so you're right. I would say ordinarily probably not, but in those kind of crisis times, people went above and beyond. And I feel like those are the kind of people that, and every improvement I tried to make at the SEC was to help those people be able to do their job better, you know, be able to prove it so that they could do better.
My guest is Norm Champ, the former director of the Division of Investment Management at the SEC. And his new book is Going Public, My Adventures Inside the SEC and How to Prevent the Next Devastating Crisis. So you left when?
So I left in January of 2015.
Okay. And you went to go back to the private sector? What are you doing now? Well, you went to write a book.
Yeah, right. Yep. First thing I did was I went to write a book. So I took a whole year off, rented one of these shared workspaces on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, uh-huh. and one of these, you know, group office places. And I worked on the book for a year. And I spoke to a variety of different people about opportunities and ultimately ended up back in private practice at a law firm, mm-hmm. and have been helping investment funds comply with the law since then. So that's mostly what I do.
One of the policies that you were instrumental in passing or areas of reform was the money market mutual fund reform. What is that? What was the problem and how was it reformed?
So in the fall of 2008, while everything else was falling apart, one main feature of the U.S. financial system was falling apart, and it didn't get as much publicity as the rest of it. Money market mutual funds are something that almost all of us are invested in,
yeah.
but most of us don't even know we're invested in. So if you have a securities account somewhere, Fidelity, you know, Vanguard, whatever, you mostly have your spare cash in a money market mutual fund that's mm-hmm. earning a little extra return as you wait to put it into a new investment or what have you. You probably filled out a form when you opened that account 20 years ago, and you don't even know that your money's going
right.
into that money market mutual fund. That's all fine. Those funds, essentially, if you put a dollar in, you get a dollar out, like a bank account. And nobody really paid any attention to any of this until the fall of 2008, when after Lehman went bankrupt on September 15th, 2008, a money market mutual fund called Reserve Primary woke up to find out that it owned $680 million worth of Lehman Brothers debt. And all of a sudden, putting a dollar in was not going to get a dollar out.
This was a relatively small money market too, wasn't it?
No, they were the biggest.
They were one of the biggest.
Yep.
They rivaled the ones you just mentioned, like Fidelity and...
They did, okay. because they were offering better returns primarily for institutional investors. And so they had attracted a lot of capital.
Okay.
And so when they woke up owning a lot of what then became, at least for the moment, worthless paper from Lehman Brothers, people started withdrawing like crazy from the money market mutual
funds. Like a bank
now.
Run on the bank.
It's a run on the bank for mutual funds. And Treasury and the Fed stepped in and guaranteed all money market mutual funds in the United States.
Yeah.
Ironically, they did so with a $34 million, M as in million, dollar fund. Money market funds were around $3 trillion.
Yeah, so, I was just going to say, what is that going to do?
What $34 million was going to do? But it shows the power of psychology in financial markets.
I gotcha.
It stopped the run on the funds.
Yeah.
But it was incumbent on the SEC, which had created this product and allowed the fixed dollar price. It was incumbent on the SEC to get organized and figure out how to reform these funds so this wouldn't happen again.
So I remember, I don't know, maybe a year ago, we got a notice. Our custodian is Fidelity. We got a notice saying that the law had changed and that now the mutual fund could break the buck, as they say.
Yep.
The dollar price per share could go below. It will start to fluctuate.
Yes.
And I think we were told if we wanted to prevent that, then put your money in a government-backed money market, which we automatically did. So is that the rule that you're referring to?
Yes. And so after a long saga, we got that rule passed in the summer of 2014. And that's why you got that notice in 16, because it was about a 2-year implementation period. And effectively what it said was, look, this product is an investment product. It's not a dollar in, dollar out bank account.
Yeah,
and so we want people to understand that it can fluctuate in value.
Yeah.
And that's what the new rule says. Now, you are correct. Your memory is great. It does allow the government funds to stay at a dollar. I was not necessarily a huge fan of that part of it, or retail funds staying at a dollar.
But
nonetheless, we got a substantial part of that market turned into a floating price.
I can see the issue, because now that everybody's going to be moving to the government, it doesn't really take the responsibility or the liability away from the government. It just kind of loads it more directly on them as opposed to indirectly on them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's had another impact, which we knew, which was a lot of people relied on that short-term funding coming into those money market mutual funds. And so now you're moving that to the government. So that funding has had to come from elsewhere over the last couple of years, many more credit funds and those kind of people providing finance.
Be careful how you fix something, right? It always has some consequence somewhere else.
Agreed.
But
I was pleased that we were able to get a significant chunk of the industry to a floating net asset value. I would have preferred all of it, but politics is the art of compromise. So we got much of it to floating.
All right. So also there's the Volcker Rule and Dodd-Frank Wall Street reform. We don't really have that much time, a couple of minutes. What involvement did you have there and what did you take away from that?
So the SEC was one of the five agencies that had to write the Volcker Rule. you know, the Volcker rule is just, it's nothing but Glass-Steagall turned into a big bureaucratic rule. So
we're going to say mess or?
Yes. I mean, we could have had Glass-Steagall where you just separate banks and investment banks. Instead, they kept them together and they wrote the Volcker rule to try to separate the two impacts.
Yeah.
It's a complicated rule. It gives a lot of power to regulators. I don't really think it helps safety and soundness very much, but doesn't look to me like there's going to be much appetite to change it in the new administration. So it seems like it's here to stay.
One last thing. You had addressed this. You're in favor of increased financial literacy and education, of course, and who isn't? But you mentioned one thing here. Force the lottery to do truthful advertising. What is that all about?
So after making a bunch of policy recommendations in Chapter 10, I do think that the number one way that Americans can prepare for the next crisis is to improve their own balance sheets, increase their own savings, use tax-free savings accounts, which are one of the rare breaks offered by the IRS system. And one of the things that's so frustrating is that government, instead of encouraging savings, encouraging individuals to create their own balance sheets and strengthen their own balance sheets, instead advertises relentlessly the worst investment in human history, which is the lottery.
Yeah.
The lottery is a monopoly. They pay about half of the what they take in out to the people who win, and then they tax even that over a certain level.
Right.
Your odds of winning are about the same as being hit by lightning. And the saddest part, low-income New Yorkers spend, and I talk about this in the book, low-income New Yorkers spend about 10% of their income on lottery tickets.
Oh, wow.
I could take that income. You could. We could invest that in a tax-free account.
Absolutely.
Those people would have a net worth.
Yeah.
And so I'd like to, the lottery is exempt from truth in advertising laws. It's a monopoly. Mm-hmm. I would like to see big changes there to stop this tax, which is a regressive tax on lower income Americans.
Wow, that's a very good point. Norm Champ is my guest, the former director of the Division of Investment Management at the SEC. His new book is Going Public, My Adventures Inside the SEC and How to Prevent the Next Devastating Crisis. And obviously, it's a book about what has happened, what is currently happening, and also Norm's thoughts about other things that need to be fixed. To find out more about Norm and to hear this interview again, don't forget to join us and join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Thank you so much for joining me, Norm. It was great.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.